as much as by the four rivers that surround it. Railroads have shaped our region. These threads of timber and steel have bound us together. They've taken our goods to market, connected us to the world, and even shaped the very landscape. Over the next hour, we'll hear stories of how the rails came to our region and how they've affected our culture, our communities, and our families. We'll explore where the railroads have taken us and discover where they may yet lead. So, settle in for the ride. The fare's on us as we head down West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail, a special presentation of WKMS News. Todd Hatton. It's not quite one in the morning when railroad historian and author Cliff Downey, producer Shelley Baskin, and I arrive at Carbondale, Illinois' Amtrak station. We're here to ride the city of New Orleans all the way to Fulton, Kentucky, on part of the old Illinois Central Line, first laid over a century and a half ago. It's the perfect place to look back at the once and future history of the railroads that run the length and width of the Four Rivers region. And as our train pulls away from the station, we begin with a piece that illustrates how deep our rail routes run. Drew Adams brings us this story of the now retired short line Cadiz Railroad and the men who undertook the backbreaking task of building and running those rails by hand.
Stan White is on a small section of railroad track alongside chattering birds and nearby traffic in Cadiz, Kentucky. The track emerges from an overgrown bush and continues until it meets a grass-covered berm. The only thing situated on the track is a single locomotive, looking off into the distance as if it's about to depart. This small 40-foot piece of track holds special significance for Stan.
This is the midpoint of the Cadiz Railroad. It ran from Cadiz to Gracie. It was 10 miles. And this is one of the last three locomotives the railroad owned. When it was abandoned, they had three.
Stan's grandfather had the railroad built in 1902 to make a link between Cadiz and the IC, or Illinois Central. His grandfather was president of the company until his death in 1925. Stan says the line was part of the lifeblood of Trigg County.
And our big business was passengers. In 20 or 21 was our biggest passenger year, and they had over 20,000 passengers.
Stan would eventually become president himself and serve in that capacity until he retired in 1985. And while he was not alive when the track was being laid, he remembers hearing his grandfather recount a time when rail was sorely needed.
The reason the railroad was built was tobacco. Originally, tobacco was hauled to Canton and put on riverboat. Then the railroad was built through Gracie. But that was an all-day job, taking a load of tobacco to Canton on a mud road that's sometimes almost impassable in the winter.
In order to build the railroad, Stan's grandfather needed hardy men who were willing to do the backbreaking work of laying the track in western Kentucky. And while there wasn't much in the way of mechanical aid, workers weren't in short supply.
Well, it took a lot of labor. Of course, labor was cheap then.
Once a general route had been selected, surveyors would come and mark the best place for the track to lay. They would do their best to stick to level ground, but often that was impossible.
They talk about all the curves in the railroad. Well, they didn't have equipment to make big cuts and fills. They went around a hill or followed a creek and meandered.
Brute force was the only mechanical advantage these men had aside of animals.
The railroad was built with mules pulling a pond scraper. Big scoop, and the mule pulled it, and they'd scoop up dirt and dig it in the ground and pull, and then they'd take it and dump it and make fills or cuts.
The act of placing track was backbreaking. Once materials were shipped to the work site, men were tasked with moving the ungainly wooden cross ties and metal track into place. Often the task of moving the cross ties fell to one man, dragging them along the ground with metal tongs. Others would be tasked with carrying the metal rails and setting them into place. Still others would lift, bend, and otherwise manipulate previously joined track so that workers could level the ties. Each task was difficult and carried with it a laundry list of potential injury. To the men, an easy day was one in which massive, pre-assembled sections of track would make their way to the work site. Former train engineer John Maxfield says it wasn't all that easy.
And so you'd get a dozen guys on each side, and you'd pick up this section of track that weighed probably a ton in unison, and off you'd go.
Once set, the workers would drive the railroad stakes into the cross ties, locking the track into place. This was called spiking the track. Passersby who witnessed these men noticed the rhythm arising from the work site, and soon a nickname was born. Bob Johnston, with the Paducah chapter of the National Railway Historical Society, explains.
Dandy dancers was what they called the people who worked on the railroad tracks because they were kind of dancing. They had a rhythm, the way they swung that hammer and spiked those rails.
John Maxfield says Gandy dancers use the rhythm inherent in their work to keep crews focused on the task at hand.
The leader of the track gang was kind of like the army, you know, hup, two, three, four, but you'd have sort of a marching song or something, and you'd kind of dance along doing your job.
Amidst the oppressive heat, searing cold, and immense number of dangers, Gandy dancers would lay an impressive amount of track in one day. A famed crew in 1869 was praised for their effort of laying 10 miles of track in a single 12-hour period. Constructing the track for the railroad wasn't the end of manual labor. Locomotive traffic, environmental factors, and the occasional derailment helped to create a need for constant maintenance. This brought about a need for section teams. These were groups of men headed by a foreman who would be responsible for a set length of track, usually 10 to 15 miles. These teams would then manage the upkeep of these stretches of track. Katy's Railroad employed at least 10 men for this task who would work daily to keep the short, 10-mile track in working order. I'm Drew Adams.
I'm Todd Hatton. You're listening to West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail. By the way, if you're wondering what some of the noises in the background are, they are the sounds of the city of New Orleans, the train that we are on right now, headed toward Fulton, Kentucky. Cliff Downey, what percentage of the rails that ran through the region were private?
Almost all of them were privately owned. I mean, almost exclusively. The Illinois Central Railroad, it was built using land grants. That was back in the 1850s, but the railroad itself was always privately owned. The railroad was granted a strip of land all along the path of the railroad, and then it would sell that land and then use that money to pay for construction costs. And I remember when I was a kid, there were trains that would carry laborers, and they would live on the work trains. They would tie up in the siding, you know, they may live there for about a week or so, and then they would go on down the tracks and so on and so forth. Today, it has changed an awful lot. The workers, they'll stay in motels and so forth, and they have mechanized machines and so forth, but it's still backbreaking work.
The scenery that's passing by the window here in the evening, looking at some of these communities, kind of puts me in mind of that, how these communities have grown up around the railroads as well. The history of many towns in West Kentucky has been shaped in large part by the coal companies and railroads that brought in jobs, money, and people. During the golden years of coal and rail in the early 20th century, these towns boomed. And when the coal ran out and the trains stopped rolling, they crashed. The city of Earlington, Kentucky is one of those towns. Shelley Baskin went to Earlington to explore the boom-to-bust history of a small West Kentucky rail town.
A little more than 10 yards from the Earlington, Kentucky City Hall, a steady stream of freight trains roll by, punctuating the quiet afternoon with blasts from their horns. The trains are just a brief interruption for the small town now. They haven't stopped here for decades. But 100 years ago, they were, along with the coal they hauled from local mines, the economic driver for the town. In 1910, Earlington had about 6,000 people living in and around the city. At the same point, the Hopkins County seat of Madisonville, just 3 miles north, had less than 5,000. Some days, as many as 100 trains passed through the city in 24 hours, with a little more than half of them stopping at the train yard in town. That's because the city and its brand new three-story train depot was the Evansville Division headquarters for the Louisville and Nashville Railroad. Local historian Ann Gibson says that meant the town had just about everything its citizens needed. She reads from a list of some of the amenities in a 1903 issue of the city's newspaper, the Earlington Bee.
Earlington was blessed with one bank, no lawyers, one bakery, one dentist, three hotels, nine groceries, two restaurants, two shoe shops, six physicians. And at that time, the coal company and the railroad They brought their own physicians in. There was usually two.
The town's residents also had access to a relatively rare commodity for turn-of-the-century rural towns, electricity. Lifelong Hopkins County resident and railroad enthusiast Wally Watts.
My grandfather told this story that they moved to Erlington about 1903. So they came on the train at night. Well, their mother was an old Scotch immigrant, and she didn't know what electric lights were. So as the train pulled into the depot, all the lights in town was on, you know. And she said, "Children, look, today it's the lightest day here."
But even with all these amenities, it was hard to find enough miners and railroad workers to keep the town going. So the mines and the railroad went out looking for workers. Gibson says recruiters would travel by rail into poor areas where unemployment was high and make those people an offer. They'd get a little bit of cash, a ticket to Erlington, and most importantly, a job. Gibson says workers made their way to the city in droves.
And there was no place for these people to stay, so one of the main, especially for women, there was no jobs for women. So these widow women who had these huge houses opened their houses and rented rooms to railroaders.
Those boarding houses provided meals and a home away from home for the railroad men, some of whom might have families in places much farther up or down the line. They also provided a unique job for local boys. Wally Watt says they were referred to as call boys.
They were teenage boys who had bicycles, and after school and on Saturdays, their job was to go to the boarding houses and wake up the crew for their train. And they'd knock on the door of the room and they'd say, "Mr. Smith, you are called for train number so-and-so at 3 o'clock.
But by the 1940s, the city's boom days were slowly being lost to the past. Erlington's economy had always been at the mercy of the coal that ran through the surrounding hills. Wally Watt says the city's decline started when coal started to run out and get too expensive to get out of the ground. When the coal production slowed, Watt says it became less important to keep the L&N Railroad's offices in the city.
The division headquarters, as I understand it, was moved to Evansville probably in the late 20s, early 30s. But the yard still stayed here and the steam handling facilities and whatnot. And then the yard itself was moved to Madisonville in about 1950.
By that time, Erlington's population had fallen to a little over 3,000 people. Madisonville had nearly 7,000. Gibson says the city limped along for the next couple of decades. Some railroad operations remained in the city, which helped keep it afloat. But eventually, the trains left too. She says the last train left Erlington in the early 1960s. With the trains gone, the L&N Railroad Depot, once the pride of the town's main street, was no longer needed. But L&N soon found they couldn't even give it away.
They offered it to the city for $1, and the city said they couldn't afford, you know, the dollar. They might could afford the dollar, but they couldn't take the upkeep. So that was one of the last really historic depots in Kentucky. I mean, it was just really unusual. And they went to no expense. You can see it was just beautiful.
But a town with no trains has no need for a train depot. So despite the beauty of the building, it was torn down on November 1st, 1963. Gibson says that was just the first of many historic buildings that were lost over the years. She says some were claimed by fires and floods, while others were torn down to make way for houses and businesses. Gibson says the only buildings left are a couple of boarding houses and a run-down building that was once a high-class hotel for coal company executives. In fact, just about the only reminders of the city's history are a main drag named Railroad Street and the mile-long freight trains that rumble past Erlington's 1,413 residents on their way to the next stop.
Woo-hoo!
I'm Shelley Baskin.
Cliff Downey, my first question after hearing a story like this is, how many miles of track were there in western Kentucky at the peak?
I would have to estimate, if you count mainline tracks as well as mine spurs and so forth, well over 1,000. Let's say 500 miles of mainline track, but then the mine spurs, maybe another 500 miles. Back in the 20s, there were probably about 75 coal mines at the time over about a 12-county area from about Central City westward.
Using that parameter, what are we at now?
probably about a third of the peak. Most of the coal mine spur tracks have been torn up. There are maybe about a dozen or so coal mines left in West Kentucky now that are served by rail.
West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail returns. We'll hear recollections of how the railroads made more than mere mechanical connections. They created human ones, too.
Those hobos would come every day.
WKMS is pleased to announce Bob Dylan and his band performing live at the CFSB Center on the campus of Murray State University Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. with special guest The Wild Feathers. Tickets are $45 and are available at the CFSB Center box office or at Ticketmaster.com. That's Bob Dylan and his band live in Murray at the CFSB Center on April 27th. We'll see you there. Support comes from contributing listeners and Mazone Communications, publisher of Paducah Life magazine and The Wedding Book. The current edition of Paducah Life features the roller derby girls of the West Kentucky Rockin' Rollers, Paducah's outstanding architecture, and the galley cooks aboard towboats. Subscription information for Paducah Life at paducahlife.com.
I'm Todd Hatton. You're listening to West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail. And we are on the city of New Orleans, the Amtrak passenger train. We are on our way to Fulton, Kentucky. I am joined by Cliff Downey, an author and railroad historian. Well, let's turn the conversation to the individuals that worked on the rails. Working on the railroad can be dangerous.
Absolutely. There are a multitude of dangers being an engineer and a conductor. Today, on almost all of the freight railroads, the engineer and the conductor, they're in the locomotive, you know, since there are no more cabooses. And grade crossing collisions, they cause an awful lot of injuries and fatalities. And track workers, you have an awful lot of heavy equipment. You're dealing with the ties and the rails and so forth, that even though you do have the heavy machinery to help move that, those can break free and crush a worker almost instantly. Also, switchmen in the freight yards, they have a lot of danger from cars that are constantly moving. And it's a very noisy environment, and so even if you're always looking around, a train can sneak up on you if you're a crew member, believe it or not. I remember a case maybe about 5 years ago. There was a switchman down at Fulton that was crushed between two cars and killed. It's a very dangerous environment.
And as dangerous as it could be for the crews who worked on and around the trains, protecting them presented its own risks. But compared to the engineers, firemen, and brakemen of folklore, the railroad special agent is somewhat less remembered. Railroad special agents are eligible for the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial in Washington, D.C. It commemorates officers who died in the line of duty. As of 2012, 149 railway officers are on the monument. 113 of them died from gunshots. 33-year-old Illinois Central Special Agent Richard Kelly was shot to death in Paducah's South Yard on May 30, 1935. But Kelly's name isn't on the memorial.
Of course, the circumstances of Mr. Kelly's death obviously couldn't be any more clearer.
That's Albert Jones. He's been a prosecutor, an FBI agent, and Paducah's mayor from 1997 to 2001. He's also worked to get Richard Kelly on the memorial. And those circumstances Jones refers to, they sound closer to Dashiell Hammett than to Casey Jones. When Freight Train 173 rolled into the Paducah Yard at about 10 o'clock on a cool, moonless night, Kelly noticed a rope dangling from the roof of one of the cars. He and railroad inspectors W.H. Perdue and R.R. Fuller knew it meant someone had tried to rob the train. When the train stopped and thinking the car held only cargo, the inspectors fell in behind Kelly as he unlatched the door and began to climb inside.
Kelly spied a glint of metal inside the dark car, a gun aimed at him. He'd never reach his pistol in time. He shouted, "Look out!" Fuller said later that's when the shooting started. One bullet struck Kelly in the upper left chest, piercing his heart and killing him instantly. Perdue later testified that after Kelly fell, three or four men jumped out of the freight car and ran towards Old Mayfield Road, firing back at the railroad men. But Albert Jones says the police were well-equipped to begin the hunt for the killer or killers.
Kelly Franklin was a classic head of detectives in Paducah. He had a tremendous reputation of having informants that just fed him all kinds of information. They knew almost immediately after it, and there's some indication in here that they were looking for the guy that did the killing just within a day or so.
At the scene, investigators found a pocket knife and a slip of paper with "We are locked in" written on it. The county coroner recovered the .45 slug that killed Kelly and sent it to the FBI. They indexed the bullet and filed it away. Then police in Illinois picked up a group of African-American men on suspicion of car theft. An officer patted one of them down, a man called West Coast. A .45 caliber automatic pistol fell out of his trouser leg. Police got the gun, but West Coast got away. The FBI tested the gun, then wired the Illinois police to see if they still had the owner in custody. But all the police had was the alias. An alias an FBI database matched to 24-year-old Roy Simmons of Paducah. Police picked him up on August 8th and charged both Simmons and his accomplice, Dubois Pearson, with murder. Simmons' trial began October 7th in Paducah. Prosecutors were convinced he was the shooter. They had the ballistics and a witness.
Her name was Daisy Butler. She testified that they were over there telling what they were going to do and then came back and said they were in a shootout.
The plan was to board a train in Princeton and while en route, tie a rope to the roof of one of the cars, climb down, open the door, get in, then tend to their target, 50 cases of liquor.
They had moved it up. It separated it from the other cargo, according to the story. So they obviously were going to get ready to take it out of there when they got to Paducah.
But they forgot the door only opened from the outside. A moving train shifts and rocks. The 173 did, and the door slammed shut, sealing them in until Dick Kelly opened it. The jury convicted Simmons and sentenced him to death. While on death row, Simmons admitted his guilt to reporters and said he was resigned to his fate. That fate came just after midnight on May 15, 1936, in Kentucky's electric chair, just 2 weeks shy of the anniversary of his crime. Kelly's widow and their three-month-old daughter had to find a way to survive, since today's railroad benefits didn't exist in 1935. Again, Albert Jones.
But the railroad did hire her as a... We had a railroad hospital here called the Illinois Central Hospital, and they gave her a job, and she was able to work there and earn a living, you know, and raise her little daughter.
That little daughter is now a grown woman with children and grandchildren of her own. Janice Cromwell says what little she knows about her father she gathered from the scattered remembrances of older friends. They painted Dick Kelly as an easygoing and fun-loving guy, but her father wasn't someone people talked about that much, especially her mother.
Mother was a private person. You know, mother had six sisters. Right after it happened, one of them lived in Detroit, and we went to Detroit with them. And they wanted us to stay, and Mother did not want to stay. And then she came back and brought a young girl from out at Granville to live with us. And she lived with us and took care of me while Mother went to work.
Mrs. Cromwell says even though her mother bore her loss quietly, and family and friends didn't for the most part talk about it, her father's murder resurfaced from time to time. One unexpected example came when her husband Bill was called for jury duty. It was a murder trial, and the defense had done its homework.
And he would not let Bill serve on the jury because he was married to me.
Everyday life tended to overshadow how her father died, even though he himself remained ever-present in the background. That's until Albert Jones entered the story and decided Richard Kelly's name deserved to be on the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. But Jones was busy being Paducah's mayor, so...
I just lost track of doing it. There's an association of railroad police, and I left it up them to get it done, but apparently it didn't get done.
Now that he's retired, and since becoming involved in this story, Jones says he might just pick up the cause again. And that would suit Janice Cromwell, a fitting tribute to a man who made police work his life, and who sacrificed that life for the law on a lonely stretch of track on a dark night long ago. For WKMS,
I'm Todd Hatton.
Well, this ship I ride on, she's the fastest one of all. And you can hear my whistle blow about a million miles. And I'm heading over this ocean to a better world to come. And you can hear my whistle blow about a million miles. You can hear my whistle blow a million miles. Hear my whistle blow a million miles. Don't you cry, don't you hang your head and sigh, 'cause you can hear my whistle blow about a million miles.
Even though the railroads could be responsible for the end of a life, they could also be responsible for the beginning of a life, or at least a new beginning for a life. To deal with orphanage overcrowding in the 1920s and 30s, the Kentucky Children's Home sent children west on trains to try to find them at least a temporary home. Whitney Jones speaks with historians and family members of orphan train riders about the harsh conditions of those times and the effect on the children who were torn away from the people and places they knew well.
In 1925, Maggie Holland gave birth to her seventh child, a boy named Elmer. In all, Maggie and her husband Buck tried to raise eight children in their struggling Hazard, Kentucky home. Just a year or two after Elmer was born, his father was shot and killed at a local bar. Maggie couldn't manage raising the eight children on her own, so she sent six of them to the Kentucky Children's Home Society outside of Louisville.
He was a bad child. He fought a lot in the orphanage from what I remember the stories he told me. He had a temper.
Sharon Stallings is Holland's daughter. She lives in Katy and says her dad tried to run away from the children's home more than six times. His unruly behavior came to a tragic tipping point in the early 1930s, when he and his younger brother Hager decided to escape the orphanage together one night.
He was pulling them across the railroad train tracks, and the train was coming too fast, and Daddy, he let go, thinking Hager was right behind him, but he didn't make it.
It was after his brother's death that the children's home sent Holland away on the orphan train. That's how he ended up in Katy's. Charlie Morris helps people like Stallings in Trigg County track down their family history, especially those descended from orphan train riders. He has found the names of more than 60 riders who were brought to Katy's between 1924 and 1936. Morris says many of the children sent west on the train were a lot like Holland.
The first ones that were sent down were either physically handicapped or maybe mentally handicapped, or were problem children in the orphanage that kept running off.
The Kentucky Orphan Train was similar to a national movement that began at the New York Children's Aid Society in 1854. In 80 years, the New York Orphanage sent more than 100,000 children west on trains. Claretta Miller was one of those children. She spoke about the New York Orphanage and her 1918 train ride across the country in an interview with Janet Graham and Edward Gray for their documentary, The Orphan Trains.
We just ate our supper thinking the next day would be just another day. But the superintendent said, I have something to tell you. She said, you're going to take your baths and you will be issued all new clothing. And tomorrow morning, very early, you will arise and board a train to go to find a new home.
Once she got off the orphan train in Nebraska, Miller was moved from home to home before finally finding the Carman family.
It just kind of hit me when I got here that I had left everything behind, which I had. I didn't have my sister anymore. I didn't have my parents anymore. I didn't have any friends, but she was with me. Mrs. Carman, she never left me for a minute, and she helped me get into bed, and that's when I began to cry. I still felt all alone, and yet I knew there was someone around me, but they were strangers. I didn't know them from Adam.
Things weren't too different in Kentucky. Elmer Holland was also separated from his siblings. He was the only one out of the six Hollands the orphanage sent west at that time. Likely before Holland reached Trigg County, where he would spend the remainder of his childhood. An ad went out in the local paper, the Katy's Record. Some of the children's home ads used passages from the Bible to stir people's hearts, and others included plights from specific children looking for a place to live, like this one, supposedly written by a boy named Eugene.
I'm just a thin little boy, 4 years old, who can eat all the potatoes and gravy and milk you have, for I've been hungry most all my life. Won't some good farmer let me help milk the cows so that I can get enough to eat and be warm all winter? I'll be a good boy. P.S. I have a little brother here, 6 years old. His name is Harold, and he is hungry too.
Once the children arrived, they would most often be taken to a church or the local courthouse to be put up for adoption, which is actually where the phrase originated. Stalin says that's exactly what happened to her father at a Blue Springs church.
The people that was picking them out, Dad said that they would feel you to see how strong you was, because mostly it was farm work to help them.
Stalin says her father wasn't happy with his placement and continued to act out at his new home. He joined the military as soon as he could at 16. But he eventually moved back to Katie's and raised Stalin's and her siblings there. Stalin says she hopes to meet her father's biological family in Eastern Kentucky at a Hollins family reunion this summer. She wants to meet the aunts, uncles, and cousins she's never met. For all the writers like Elmer Holland who are open about their past, there are many of those still living who refuse to talk about the orphan train. Charlie Morris says between the difficulties of being torn away from their parents by death or disaster and being taken in by families that did not always treat them well, the orphan train riders are justified in their resentment. But not all were unhappy with their placement. Take Claretta Miller, for example.
I was one of the lucky. They were always there for me when I needed them. Always.
Whether they loved their new families or resented them, the orphan train riders left behind many questions about their family history. Now their children must find the answers. I'm Whitney Jones.
It was a big orphan train across the high plains in the springtime of 75. Epidemics back east had filled the city streets with children that death left behind. But this ship of mad west, yeah, it'll be the best to labor for the frontier land. That was the kind big city fathers planned. Scrubbed so clean it hurt, names pinned to their shirts, lined up on the depot freight dock. You need a boy for the fields or a girl to cook the meals. Step right up, pick out the one you want. You kids hide your fears, dry all of your tears. Nobody wants a child that cries. Go ahead, little girl, kiss your brother and sister goodbye.
I'm Todd Hatton. I'm here with author and railroad historian Cliff Downey. You are listening to West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail. We are on the city of New Orleans, courtesy of Amtrak, racing through western Kentucky on our way to Fulton. When you hear a story like that, it's very easy to get the impression that almost anything that touches the railroad is really transitory. Right down from life to jobs, the economy. Was there any such thing as stability working in the railroad?
Yes and no. I've known a lot of employees that worked for the railroad for 50 years or more, but then again, they would have to move around. Some of them would work in Paducah, some in Central City, some went to Louisville, Chicago, New Orleans, and so on and so forth. The jobs on the railroad, they were based on seniority. So let's say you may temporarily fill in at, let's say, Paducah, but then if somebody with more seniority came along, they could bump you from that job, then unless you could find another job somewhere else, then you too were out of a job too. And so most railroad employees, if you had more than 10 or 20 years experience, chances are that you worked in a dozen or more different states.
By contrast, Isabella Quinn grew up in one place, Princeton. Her father drove locomotives to be cleaned or repaired there for the Illinois Central. Mrs. Quinn is a lively 90 years old, and while she may not hear quite like she used to, she remembers more than she'll ever admit. Chad Lampe and I had the pleasure of visiting with Isabella Quinn as she recounted her memories of growing up around the rails.
Now, did you say that you had hopped on a train to go see a movie sometime?
Well, 103 would go all the way from Louisville to New Orleans, and then the 102 would go from New Orleans back. Okay, we'd catch the early train somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning, go all the way to New Orleans, take in a movie, and then wait and catch the train to come back.
Was that the closest place to see a movie?
No. But we could ride a pass because Daddy worked for the railroad company.
And what movies did you see?
I don't remember. I just remember that it was a beautiful theater, something that we didn't have in Princeton.
What'd your dad do?
He was a hostler. I think that's who loads the coal cars. And he worked at what they call the roundhouse.
Tell me about the hobos.
Well, I tell you, I wished I'd been more like my mother. When those hobos would come every day, and she wouldn't feed them until they cut her wood. And we only had one to refuse to cut wood. And so I don't guess he was very hungry. And then one night, one did come, and Daddy was afraid of him, but he wanted Daddy to take him over to the railroad track, and he had my little brother to follow him. So the next day in Princeton, they arrested that hobo, and they found that he had a gun in his suitcase. But Daddy was suspicious of him, but he was the only one we had any trouble with. But I guess it'd be from 15 to 20 hobos out there in this wooded area, and we had a path through there where we'd walk from our road over to the railroad track. And I know one time we saw something on the railroad track, and what it turned out to be was a little snake. But this hobo, he didn't know what the problem was, and he came down there, and we showed him the snake, and that was the end of that one.
Trailer for sailor rent, rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bedroom. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road.
It was an absolute joy to talk to Mrs. Quinn. One of her stories prompts me to ask, how widespread was riding the rails back in the 30s?
Every community, every town, every city, there were, whatever you want to call them, hobos, vagrants. They were trying to go to other towns looking for better opportunities. A lot of times they were greeted by hostilities. I've heard stories of the special agents throwing hobos off moving trains. And it didn't matter if train was moving 40 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour, or whatnot, because the special agents had a duty to protect the freight trains and, you know, the cargo that they were carrying and so forth.
Could you talk a little bit more about the culture?
A lot of people like to paint it as being romantic and so forth, and I'm sure, you know, for a lot of people it was romantic and fun, but for a lot of people it was desperation, and it didn't always turn out well.
King of the road, every engineer on every train, and all of the children, all of their names,
and every handout in every town,
every lock that ain't locked when no one's around, I sing trailer.
When we come back, we look down the line to the railroad's future in our region, from rebuilding locomotives to repurposing rails to trails. This is West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail, from WKMS News.
Ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a...
The president takes a break from the deficit battles and heads to the Middle East. The GOP works to rebrand itself after CPAC. Hillary Clinton and Rob Portman both back same-sex marriage. And Stephen Colbert's sister faces a primary vote in South Carolina. I'm Lynn Neary. Political junkie Ken Rudin is back. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Stay with us. Talk of the Nation is ahead at 1. We are WKMS 91.3 Murray, 92.5 Paducah. We're online at WKMS.org. Support comes from contributing listeners and MSU alumnus Kenny Roof and the employees of Roof Brothers Wine and Spirits in Paducah. In addition to domestic and imported beers and wines, Roof Brothers offers custom-made gift baskets for all occasions. RoofBrothers.com.
This is West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail. I'm Todd Hatton. We're aboard the City of New Orleans, and in just a few minutes, we'll hear from author and historian Cliff Downey again. But first, in the basement of an otherwise average house in a Madisonville suburb, there exists another world where the trains always run on time. Chad Lampe brings us this audio postcard of a model crew of railroaders.
I'm Don Clayton. I'm 63. I'm a lifelong resident of Madisonville. I have been teaching for 41 years, and I'll be retiring in May of 2013. Well, I lived in a smaller house prior to moving here in 1982. I decided that it would be nice if I could afford it to have a bigger house with a bigger basement. So I went to a real estate agent and said, I'm looking at it for a house with a big basement that's not subdivided into rooms. And I thought that was perfect for long stretches where you could have a long train and see it run, like we use the word prototypically, which means it looks like and acts like and runs like the real thing.
Switches look okay, Rick?
My name is Rich Hain. I'm a retired forester. I was a district forester with the Kentucky Division of Forestry. And right now I'm 65 years old. And we're enjoying retirement. And it's pretty much been a weekly meeting that we've gotten together at least one night a week. And then sometimes we just go out and eat lunch together, a couple of us maybe. And then I'm really happy that I got into trains years ago. It's a great hobby. I've met a lot of great guys. I guess with me, it started Christmas Day, 1952. My mom and dad gave me a Lionel Santa Fe diesel train set, model train set.
My name's Rick Bivens. I'm originally from Madisonville. I currently reside in Morton's Gap. I am 50 and currently hold the position of president of the Western Kentucky Chapter National Railway Historical Society. For as long as I can remember, I can't pinpoint any one date or event. I've just always had a fascination with trains in general. My favorite railroad is the New York Central, which ran in the Northeast. The New York Central being my favorite stems back to a trip to Hopkinsville many years ago with my mom. We used to go down to the Woolworths that was in the mall there, and they had a pretty nice train cabinet, a lot of models. And there was a locomotive there that I just really liked. It was called the New York Central Hudson. Didn't have any idea what New York Central or Hudson was at the time. But mom let me put it on layaway, and I worked around the house, mowed yards, stuff like that, and got it out of layaway. That was 30 plus years ago. Still got it, too.
My name is Thomas Bryan. I'm from Roberts, Kentucky. I've lived there my entire 19 years of existence. About 8 years ago, my family was waiting to get into a restaurant here in Madisonville, and Ricky was waiting in the same line, and he noticed the book that I was reading happened to be about trains, and he asked my dad, "Is your son taking interest in trains?" And Dad said, "Yes, he does." And Rick told him about the club and the chapter and who they were, and we started attending meetings, and as of this winter, this will be 9 years for me. What I like about trains is there are very few things that have shaped this country the way it is, except for the railroads. They extended our reach west for this country. They made it possible to ship products and people faster. There's so many innovations by the railroads that have actually made our country what it is, such as the time zones. Time zones were established by the railroads because each city used to have its own time based on when noon was.
These are track rheostats. These are power for the main lines. Wally Watts, Jr., and I was born here, lived here all my life. I lived in three houses my whole life, and I'm 82 years old, and I don't feel like I'm over 16. Well, if you have an interest and enjoy devoting yourself to it and participating in it, it keeps you young. It creates an interest, and I associate with younger people, like Thomas.
Let's fire up the California Limited here. Now, this is a scale model
what the Santa Fe Railroad, one of their crack trains, it'll look like in the late 30s or real early 40s. The real one was built in 1937. Santa Fe had six of them. They were capable of well over 100 miles an hour. Well, when I was a kid, I couldn't afford the electric one, so I just had the little cheap wind-up trains, mechanical trains. And even then, well, the electric trains then were just, you know, simple. Just electric motors and rheostat to control the speed. I see pictures and read about the glory days of passenger trains. It'd be romantic and glamorous to ride those trains.
Whoa! Whoa! Whoa, whoa! Gospel train is coming. Better get your ticket now. You better set your house in order, friend. You know the train's gonna be here tonight all along. Don't you hear the whistle blow? Hear the bells are gone. Can't you hear the engine exhaust, friend? You know the train's gonna be here tonight all along. Now before she enters the pearly gates of heaven, can't you imagine can hear the train?
VMV Paducahbilt, a subsidiary of National Railway Equipment, is one of the oldest locomotive factories in America and one of the largest suppliers of locomotives in the world. Built in 1925 by the Illinois Central Railroad, this factory hasn't shut its doors in 85 years. John Walker toured the facility on Kentucky Avenue to learn how Big Rail is alive and growing.
From the outside, the massive brick and steel complex making up VMV Paducahbilt looks quiet and abandoned. Inside, it's anything but.
And now to build a new locomotive, and that's in a different building, they can be in that building about 4 months to build it from start to finish.
VMV Vice President and General Manager Bob Pedersen doesn't complain much. Not when his knee hurts, which he attributes to his rowing days at Purdue. Not when, 15 years ago, he brought his family from Chicago to work in Paducah. And not when he walks VMV's 110-acre lot. But he will be the first to tell you how much locomotives have changed over the years. He points at a half-assembled locomotive where an electrician is working on circuits.
These are the generators that the diesel engine turns. And then this creates electricity that goes through the high-voltage cabinet and then turns the electric motors on each axle.
VMV is known for rebuilding engines, many from the 1960s, and giving them another 30 years on the line. Pedersen says although rail has the image of an age long gone, it's actually keeping up with other industries, especially in the environmental standards category.
The thing that we're also doing is bringing older units up to newer emission standards, and National Railway Equipment has its own certification for improving the emission standards on locomotives.
In 2008, the EPA passed new rules to reduce train emissions by as much as 90%. But VMV has technology for new locomotives called generator sets, or gensets. Gensets use three engines instead of one, allowing a computer to determine how many engines to use at a given time. That changes the amount of diesel a locomotive uses from an average of 122 gallons per hour to 68.
Which is environmentally very friendly, and we've built hundreds of those that have gone into the Union Pacific and the Burlington Northern. I mean, we feel very strongly that type of environmental issues are going to spread throughout the country, and we've got to be ready for it.
That's great for new locomotives, but what about all those old locomotives from 30 years ago?
National Railway Equipment has developed what we call Tier Zero Plus technology, that you can take these old engines, put different parts in them, time them differently, and they run a lot cleaner without loss of horsepower.
Building and refurbishing engines isn't all they do here. Electronics, welding, wheel sets, durability testing, battery installation, and that's not even half of it. There's even a design team to create logos for customers. Unlike other industries, VMV isn't worried about falling demand. Right now, there's one shift for 160 workers at VMV, and Pedersen says he has enough orders to add another, but he can't find the workers.
I mean, I hire boilermakers, welders, electricians, and with the sophistication
going so much higher than it was a few years ago, it's hard to find, especially electricians, that can become familiar with the sophistication of a locomotive.
For Pedersen, sophistication means computers. Trains, like the rest of us, have entered the digital age, and someone has to piece all of that together. In a rural market, it's not an easy position to fill. But technological advances are not the only setback. There's also the issue of finding committed workers.
It's not the easiest work in the world. It's rough work, and some of the people don't want to come to work every day. I mean, it's just something that's happening to our economy that is very different than it was many years ago.
But unlike other transportation industries, VMV is growing. And that, he says, is partly due to the company's global outlook.
What our philosophy of our owner is to broaden our perspective, not just from the U.S., but to go overseas, so that if there is an economic slowdown in the U.S., you can offset that by something in the world market. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. The locomotives that we're building for Saudi Arabia and Africa is really helping out the manpower and the sales and profitability of the company.
But even though VMV exports are growing, Pedersen never forgets the legacy of trains and their importance here in the U.S. When I asked him if he thinks the Rust Belt is dead...
Well, you just walked around. I didn't look very dead today. And this is traditional United States smokestack industry.
I'm John Walker.
Listening to West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail. We're speaking with author and railroad historian Cliff Downey. It's been pointed out to me that one of the reasons why passenger rail has declined is because the perception of rail's prevalence has declined, because freight rail, which is far and away the greater volume of traffic, is not very obtrusive. I mean, you can drive around a community and never see a train.
A lot of the freight traffic is now concentrated on, you know, a handful of rails, and so, yeah, you can drive around and one community may have a lot of trains and then go to the next one and they'll have some tracks, but then, you know, you won't see a train at all. It kind of fools some people into thinking that trains are dying off, and they're not.
As the nation becomes increasingly concerned about the environment, people are recycling more and more, giving a new life to various items, even abandoned railways. The city of Hopkinsville has begun a rails-to-trails project, revamping an old Fort Campbell track into a beautiful new walkway, which officials hope will benefit the city. Casey Northcutt has more on the city's railroad recycling.
Hopkinsville Director of Community and Development Services Steve Bourne starts up a John Deere Gator and drives me down an old Department of Defense railway that used to haul Fort Campbell soldiers and equipment through town. In the middle of February, the trees are bare and there isn't much of a view, but Bourne paints an interesting picture of what this area could look like in the future. In the next year or two, when the flowers bloom, a walkway will cover the current bed of gravel and connect residential neighborhoods, commercial areas, and picturesque sections of the city.
And the city now has this opportunity to really have a unique feature. But part of the appeal here is that you are up against the river, and you do have some of those natural settings. And we'll go down through.
Hopkinsville is home to more than 31,000 people, and according to its health department's 2012 Community Health Assessment Study, the city and county rank at the bottom for communities statewide that provide a physical environment promoting health. Yet Bourne says Hopkinsville leaders have been contemplating a rails-to-trails project for at least 6 years. Such an endeavor could help the infrastructure issue. Several trails already exist in cities nearby, including Nashville, Clarksville, and even Katy's. Now, Hopkinsville's new walkway will join more than 20,000 miles of converted rail beds across the country thanks to efforts from the Rails to Trails Conservancy. The nonprofit is dedicated to creating a nationwide network of paths where railways once stood. Eric Oberg is the Conservancy's manager of trail development in the Midwest region.
We certainly try to pay attention to what people are doing, and the group there is doing wonderful things. Your mayor seems to be a big champion here, and I think he's to be commended for putting his best foot forward and seeing the reasons that this project can be a great asset for the community.
Oberg says his organization serves mainly as an information source for trail efforts around the nation, and that local groups take ownership of these projects. Back at the trail site, Bourne says his city has taken ownership of its walkway and pushed so hard for its creation because the project will help Hopkinsville further establish its own community identity.
What you're trying to do in any community development effort is develop a sense of place, a sense of purpose. And having these types of assets provide that sense of place where people want to be a part of and have access to.
As we drive down the gravel rail bed, we pass through an interesting cross-section of the city, including industrial centers and residential neighborhoods. Kids play nearby, and Bourne even stops to talk to a woman walking her dog.
That's a pretty dog you have.
People already walk along the rail bed, which Bourne says the Department of Defense donated to the city around 7 years ago. He hopes, though, that even more residents will utilize it if city officials can drum up the estimated $1.7 million to pave the path and to construct railhead facilities and bridges. Mayor Dan Kemp says they have applied for one governmental grant and received another, but the city and private sector will fund the bulk of the construction. A group called the Pennyrail Rail Trail Foundation even hosted an annual fundraiser for the project, but the entire community has not always backed the Rails to Trails effort. Kemp admits that some residents had reservations about the safety of the trail as well as about the fact that it would run by several backyards.
I think a lot of those concerns and objections have been addressed. And you hardly ever have a project that's 100% supported, but I'm confident that a pretty sizable majority of the people in Hopkinsville, as well as the city council, support this project.
Kemp hopes to finish at least the first phase of the trail, or the first 3 miles, by the end of the year. When finished, the trail will run about 8 miles through the city, linking both residential and commercial areas, so citizens can walk to the park or to the downtown shops. This way, Kemp and Bourne believe the project will boost the quality of life in the city.
It's just a great thing to be close to a rail trail that you can get out there and walk and jog and ride bikes. We need areas like that. We particularly need in Hopkinsville.
And trails like that could make Hopkinsville a healthier place in general. Kemp certainly hopes so as he pushes for citywide rail bed recycling. I'm Casey Northcutt.
The city of New Orleans is pulling into the Fulton Station. That means we're coming to the end of our trip. Author and railroad historian Cliff Downey, thanks for coming with us.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it very much.
I'm Todd Hatton. We'd like to thank the people who've made this trip possible, the Paducah and West Kentucky chapters of the National Railway Historical Society, Albert Jones, Bill and Janice Cromwell, Wally Watts, Stan White, Ann Gibson, H.B. and Isabel Quinn, and the orphan train documentarians Janet Graham and Edward Gray. West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail, was produced and written by Chad Lampe, Todd Hatton, Shelley Baskin, Drew Adams, Whitney Jones, and John Walker. And a special thanks to Amtrak, their Carbondale, Illinois station staff, and the crew of the City of New Orleans. And thank you for coming along on West Kentucky High Iron, the story of Four Rivers Rail, a special presentation of WKMS News.
This is WKMS FM 91.3 HD1 in 2 Murray, WKMD 90.9 FM HD1 in 2 Madisonville, and WKMT 89.5 FM Fulton. We are Murray State University's NPR station. We appreciate the support of contributing listeners in Ashland and Calvert City, Ashland manufactures specialty chemicals for a variety of industries, including personal and oral care, pharmaceuticals, and agriculture. Sunny skies this afternoon, a high in the mid-40s, tonight clearing with a low near 20. Good afternoon, it's 1 o'clock. I'm Tracy Ross. Up next, it's Talk of the Nation.